Hello and welcome to the Arch Insurance Pursuing Better Together podcast, where we talk to luminaries from both inside and outside the industry about how they have pursued better within their chosen professions.
Today I am very pleased to be speaking to Kate Richardson-Walsh, gold medal winning captain of the great British women's hockey team and the most capped female hockey player in British history, who led the team undefeated to gold during the Rio Olympics in 2016. Awarded an MBE in 2015 and an OBE in 2017, Kate also holds the highest accolade available in her sporting profession, the England Hockey Member of Honour. Following her retirement from the sport, she now focuses much of her time on coaching, motivational speaking, and ambassadorial roles. Kate, welcome to Arch Insurance's Pursuing Better Together podcast. It's an absolute pleasure to be speaking to you.
Thanks very much for that very warm welcome, Nigel.
Can I start by going straight to that gold medal success in Rio? Can you just give me a sense of how it felt to lead the great British women's hockey team onto the top of that podium?
Yeah, goodness me, it seems a long time ago now. Time has absolutely flown. But if I can kind of close my eyes, I can take myself back there. And I think there was such a mixture of emotions, certainly relief, you know, having played international hockey for 18 years and really believed for 18 years that we had it within us to do that. There was certainly a lot of relief, but an overwhelming amount of pride for the squad that was there, for the players that we represented who weren't there, for all our friends and family who, you know, supported us on that journey. And of course, all the coaching staff and the backroom staff who we just wouldn't have been there without. And,
absolutely.
And all the public as well.
And of course, it wasn't just securing gold, but to do it without a single defeat along the way. That must have added an extra cherry kind of thing. You know, it was a really, truly phenomenal team of players.
Yeah, it was. And we said it was the most mindful I think we've ever been for a prolonged period of time. So, you know, that's 14 days. So that's 8 games in 14 days. And it just felt like we were one. We were very much aligned in terms of our culture and our behaviours and our habits and our processes and in everything and in every way. We knew what each other and we as a team needed to do to go out there and get each of those wins just one at a time.
Of course, and as you say, it was a long period of time for that intense focus. I'm kind of curious that just in that context, you know, did you have to change how you were leading the team during the Olympics as it progressed? And how also were you preparing the team for the final itself?
No, and that's one of the things we spoke about beforehand. And it was about actually not changing anything because under pressure and under stress, you know, we all react very differently. And fortunately, we'd been trained by our coaching staff, both within a hockey context and outside of that context, to understand how we all individually and as a collective deal with pressure and actually to be able to manage our state in that environment and to maintain some equilibrium. Because if I suddenly start behaving erratically, you're absolutely not going to know what to do to play with me, to help me.
Of course, yes.
And in a team environment, that can be really destructive. So actually, we had just a well-honed set of behaviours and routines and habits that we were built into our programme months in advance of those 2 weeks. So effectively, nothing had to change.
Yes, so it was essentially just falling back on the training that had already gone into it. And as you say, almost that sense of programming.
Yeah, I think so often, you know, and because it's how we consume lots of things nowadays, we see the magic and the sparkle of the Olympic Games or the Paralympic Games or the Football World Cup. And we think, wow, you know, everything's perfect. And they must have just had to have done something extra special to have gone and achieved whatever they've achieved. And actually, it's much more boring to know all about, you know, the same old, and actually doing nothing different. And you don't need to do anything magnificent or spectacular that's never been done before. It is already within you.
Sure. And you touched upon this already, but there were so many other people critical to that success that, of course, didn't get to stand on the podium that day. And I suppose there must be a real sense of responsibility that you feel to the team in its entirety when you're standing there and you're having that moment in the spotlight.
And honestly, I think if I had to pick out one thing, I think it was that sense of responsibility and understanding, deep level of understanding of what it means to be a great, excellent teammate. I think that set us apart from everybody else under pressure. And I think that came from having been empowered to build our culture. We owned and had responsibility for our vision, our values and our behaviours. They were ours, in our words. we were driving them, and if it failed or if it succeeded, that was absolutely down to us. And I think that sense of responsibility was in every single player. And as you said, whether they were standing on that podium or not, that sense of responsibility was very real.
Yeah, absolutely. And I want to, if I can, Kay, just to actually step back a little bit and sort of, you know, go back to that, the initial stages, the fledgling stages of your career. You know, did you always have that drive to win that has clearly helped you achieve so much in your career today? Was that always there, even from an early age?
My parents were both sporty. My mum and dad were both PE teachers, both played lots of different sports. Mm-hmm. So my sister and I, you know, couldn't really escape that kind of sporty, competitive sure. family environment. And whether that was board yeah. games at Christmas or, you know, playing one-on-one in the hallway with a hockey stick, that was, I suppose, always there. And I swam yeah. into gymnastics a lot as a youngster, which was obviously quite that individual focus.
Of course, yeah.
Team sport that I'd ever played. So I think there was that sense of, for me, certainly winning was something that I wanted, but there's also just that sense of doing something with people that you are aligned with, having fun, socializing with. I think there was definitely those two aspects that were always woven in throughout my career.
Yeah, and of course, and as you said, that sort of, that team mentality, but there was also that you became a leader very quickly. There was that, there was, I suppose, something that kind of set you apart from others in the team, whether that was something that you saw or something that others saw. And obviously when you joined the Great British squad in 1999, 4 years later, you were appointed captain of the senior team. At that point, and obviously this is, we're talking sort of 2003.
Yeah.
What was it that they saw in you, the senior sort of figure saw in you? What did you see in yourself that enabled you to take on that level of responsibility and accept the mantle of leadership?
I mean, I wish I'd thought about that more at the time. I think I was in so much shock, and I obviously felt very proud and I felt very humbled by being voted into that position first and foremost by my teammates. So they'd given me that kind of mandate to say, we want you to lead us, which I think from the beginning, you know, from the off, felt like, well, okay, they must have voted me in for a reason.
Sure.
But I didn't necessarily put too much time and thought into it. And looking back, I think, and having had conversations since, I think one of the major reasons they voted me in at that time was because of the standards that I set myself, what I held myself to account to, was constantly driving and pushing to be better in every aspect.
Gotcha. Yeah.
Training and everything else. And also I was a student of the game. Like, I just loved every aspect of the game. Yeah. And I communicate that really clearly on the field. And I think at that time, I think the players in that group, that's what they felt they needed from a captain.
Sure.
And so that was kind of where I started, I suppose, my captaincy. But, you know, if I look back to 2003 to where I ended up in 2016, and even where, you know, I'd like to think I am now, there's so much growth and difference over that period.
Well, that's it. I suppose a position like that, there is a responsibility on you to make it your own and to be your own and to learn. It's kind of, you're learning on the job, I suppose, you know, you're learning how to be a leader because you're given that mantle, and then you have to learn how to fully take it on board. And how did you go about doing that? How did you take ownership of it? And I don't even know if that's the right word. Do you take ownership of leadership? I don't know. But how did you go about that?
For me, it was about talking to lots of different people, embracing what I could at the time. If I think now how much breadth of and depth of information there is through, you know, TED Talks or books or podcasts. This, for example, you know, there's lots of different ways you can consume and get curious about how different people lead. And then for me, it was about, you know, what I could have mostly through books at that time and conversations. And watching various kind of documentaries and things, but actually then turning it within to actually say, okay, you know, what resonates with me, what sparks something in me, what sounds like things that I have, what are the qualities that I have, and how does it knit
with
the way I view the world, what I value in myself, in other people, in teams, and then just over time, you know, just trying things and just developing things over the years. I think one of the major influences pretty early on was two books that I read, one by Phil Jackson called 11 Rings, about his time as the NBA coach at the Chicago Bulls and the LA Lakers. And then Bill Walsh's book, The School Take Care of Itself, and that's about the whole cultural transformation of an NFL team. And both of them, what they spoke about, standards, leading from within, that kind of connection with people, and building of something greater, like that bigger purpose, that really, you know, really sparked something in me, I think helped me develop my leadership quite early on.
Yes, and I suppose as well that, you know, as we've already touched upon it, it is that constant learning. And you're as I say, you're learning on the job, you're learning from the situations that you find yourself in, some very challenging situations. And often, you know, if you look at your career, there are so many highs in that career, so many positives, so many medals, so many successes. But I suppose also, you know, as a leader, you've got to be able to lead through more challenging times when things aren't going as well, and you're not perhaps reaching the heights that you should be reaching, that the team should be reaching. And I suppose one of those situations was in 2014, when, of course, you know, the team finished, I think it was 11th out of 12 in the Hockey World Cup. And you know, that must have been an incredibly difficult period for the team.
Yeah, it was an incredibly difficult time for everybody. And I think partly because in the lead up to the London Olympic Games, there was a real understanding from that whole group, so from kind of 2009 to 2012, that everybody was a leader, whether you're an assigned leader or not, you were leading yourself first and foremost, and then you have the responsibility to also lead the people around you. Yeah. And that kind of fell away a little bit after London with a kind of change of culture, and we all kind of lost our way and went from being quite a highly competitive and high pressured environment, but also felt psychologically safe in that lead up to London, to feeling uncertain and unsafe and quite volatile. And I think in that environment, you know, people tend to retreat, and whether that's kind of go internal and becoming more introverted and not being vulnerable and prepared to share, or they might gather in small groups because that feels safer. And as a leader in those times, it's really hard to manage your own state and your own kind of mental health and how you're feeling and viewing things. Be cognizant and aware of how everybody else is dealing with in very different ways. Because although the team, in a cultural sense, I felt was really struggling, there were some players absolutely in there who felt like actually things were going really well for them. And that's challenging.
You know, obviously, there had to be some very difficult conversations that needed to take place. And you've got sort of so many very strong personalities in that kind of environment, very different perspectives on what the issues are or were at that time. You know, can you give me a sense of what those conversations at that point were like?
Yeah, I think when it was good, I think challenge and challenging conversations and hard conversations were not avoided, because they were able to be had because they were done in a sense of with low risk, and it felt like it was done from a place of care and of understanding of what the challenge was against. It was against our culture that was created. Yeah. In that environment when we were struggling, challenge was now my word against yours, and it wasn't necessarily back towards and, you know, being backed up by that foundation of piece of that culture that we'd all agreed on. And so it became you making me vulnerable, and that's not vulnerability, that's just thrown somebody under the bus, frankly. And we had some really, really, I mean, very memorable, unfortunately, but very raw, hard, emotive conversations that were not positive, I don't think, in any sense, other than, I suppose, from everything you experience. But It needed us to finish, as you said, 11th out of 12 at the World Cup in that England team, to kind of have a line in the sand and say, okay, let's actually get everything out on the table.
Yes.
Have an external facilitator come in and just leave nothing unsaid, no elephants in the room, no stone left unturned. Give everybody every opportunity to say whatever they feel they need to say, and start recreating that safe space so that people could start to rebuild that trust that had been completely broken.
Well, that's a really interesting point as well that you raised there, that, you know, had you not finished 11th, had you managed to maybe finish mid-table, those conversations that needed to happen might not have happened. You wouldn't have had that sort of like that feeling of being exposed and knowing that fundamentally things were broken. Or is that an unfair comment?
No, I don't think it's unfair at all. I think it's a really absolutely valid perspective and point of view. And I would, it's hard to say, but I would say that, you know, if I look the first 10 years of my career, I think that happened often, actually. Right. I think, you know, we've kind of finished maybe eighth or sixth, and you think, oh, great, it's not so bad, you know, well, you know, not in our world bank and everything else. But actually, I think conversations that were being had at a high level and above our heads before that 11th place finish, I think would have ensured that a deeper level of introspection and review would have taken place anyway.
Yeah. And how did that process then take shape? Because obviously there is a period of rebuilding, reestablishing of foundations, I suppose, and not just sort of from a training perspective, but as you said, culturally, it wasn't working. And that team perspective, just that solidity, that oneness probably wasn't there. How do you go about creating then the foundations that then enable you to move forward from that?
Well, I mean, it started with the bravery and courage, frankly, of the old coach who had taken us to bronze in London 2012. He came back and again empowered the group, which, if you think about where the group was at that time, it was quite a toxic environment. It wasn't a safe culture. There was no vulnerability. To come in and say, okay, let's together with the management team, let's build our vision, values and behaviours, and this is about everybody. Now, that's a real brave thing to do, because at that time it would be far easier and I would feel far more comfortable probably to say, okay, this is the sense of direction, get on board or get off.
Yes.
But he needed buy-in and he needed it to be about every single person. And that's the only way we were going to go and do anything in Rio, you know, 18 months later. So, and that's where it all started. It was about that conversation and the building of our vision to be the difference, create history, inspire the future.
Yeah, I suppose that gives you that solidity, that security, that safety, that you go, okay, now we can all move forward together and we all have that clarity of vision and purpose.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And then there's then the conversations that then you have, the richness of those conversations about, okay, well, what values underpin that vision? You know, this vision is beautiful and it's meaningful and it means something to all of us, but day to day, what are we going to build into our training, into our gym sessions, into our reviews? Yes. You know, what are the values and ultimately what were the behaviors, and what's that framework of behaviors that we are going to say this is tolerable and this is required in this environment, and actually these behaviors are intolerable and things that we absolutely cannot have. Mm-hmm. And it was those real open conversations that where there was absolutely challenge and disagreement and healthy friction, where I think we really brought out the best of ourselves at that time.
It's interesting as well, you describe it there as a healthy environment, and it is healthy to have those types of conversations. And as long as you're in that sort of safe, controlled space so that you know, that people feel comfortable and feel that they can actually have those. You touched upon there as well, the sort of the training aspects, that because, you know, you've got the culture components, but you've also got the training aspects that are designed, I suppose, to facilitate that team mentality that is, and obviously the skills, et cetera, and the abilities, but also just that team mentality that really does support your ability to achieve that vision. But you also had some rather unusual sort of training techniques, I believe, that were applied. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, was it Pressure Thursday, I think?
Oh, Thinking Thursday, yeah.
What was that? Can you talk me through that?
Yeah, so Thinking Thursday was, I mean, it kind of hit everything, every aspect of our values, certainly. So our values that underpinned that vision were we are winners, we are one team, be alive. And so Thinking Thursday was small-sided games. You'd be sent an email on Wednesday night about, I think I'd finished club training, so about 10 p.m. I'd get this email. And you'd be put in a team, different team every week, and you'd be given a set of rules. The rules would be different every week. The size of the field would be different every week.
Right.
How you scored points would be different every week.
Yeah.
And you basically had between that point of getting that email and 8:30 the next morning to get yourselves ready to go and find a way to win as a team. And it was about winning as a team.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But within that, of course, there was that sense of needing to perform, be at your best, be there, be present, be fully at your very best self, as best as you can be on that day, be alive to go and help your team win. And so there's a lot of managing state, and the coach within the session would kind of throw curveballs to kind of poke you a little bit in a metaphorical sense, you know, so he might piss you off for no reason.
Sure. He
might make your team play with one less player. He might change the rules on you in the middle of the game to force you to deal with the emotions that that causes, because that's going to happen in Olympic games. That's going to happen. That pressure and that stress
Absolutely.
Will be there.
That's a great learning environment.
Oh, it was, I mean, it was brilliant. It was hard. It was hard. This was one of our last physically hard sessions of the week. So it would have been our fifth pitch session of the week. We'd had two heavy gym sessions at this point. We'd done all our psychology and nutrition. And at this point, we were fatigued mentally and emotionally and physically. So it was about absolutely pushing yourself to the end and then finding something extra for your team. Being able to think clearly. I know Sir Clive Woodward talks about with the England men's rugby team in 2003, he talks a lot about teacup, think correctly under pressure. And this was kind of aligned to that. It's like, can you think clearly in the madness and the chaos of stress and pressure? Can you still think and behave in a way that your teammates are going to understand and be able to work with?
And what did you learn about yourself during those sort of like, because obviously, as you see, you're absolutely out of your comfort zone. You're really being tested. You're being pushed to your limits. You know, you must have found out some pretty interesting things about yourself during those sessions.
Yes, I was very much labelled myself anger management. I think he on purposely put all the anger management players in one team quite regularly, and we often have bright orange bibs as well, just to kind of create that visual of the anger.
Sure.
But it was how quickly, you know, I can be distracted by that emotive reaction to what I deem as a bad decision or something that's unfair or unjust. And what impact that was not only having on me, but also my teammates, how it affected my communication, my vision, my ability to see things. So it was the best training. It was the worst, but also the best training environment we could have had.
I wanted to go back to one of the points that you made sort of earlier, and when we were talking about that sort of early stages of your leadership, and you said that, you know, that obviously it has changed and it has evolved, but you know there's so many things you wish you had known then that you know now, of course, but you captained the team for 13 years, which is an incredible length of time to be in that position. How do you think your leadership changed during that 13-year period?
Oh goodness, I think initially I was quite a shy, introverted, and I suppose I lacked confidence, particularly in a leadership role in the beginning. Mm-hmm. And so I was constantly giving a lot of energy and thought to, you know, what's everybody thinking of me? Not in a way of, you know, am I serving people, which I think is a good thought. A good thought would be, to, you know, am I serving people that I'm needing in the appropriate way? But it was too, being too worried about judgment and spending too much energy and time on that. And actually, when I started to think about, you know, serving people, like they voted me in for a reason and I'm here to serve them. How can I best serve them? What does kindness and care look like in this environment? And sometimes that was, you know, a really hard conversation and a hard word. More often than not, it was an open embrace and conversation and sharing of space with and building a relationship with all my teammates. And also being aware as a leader that, and this was the hardest one, that I couldn't be all things to all people all the time.
Of course. Yeah.
As much as my ego desperately wanted me to be, I absolutely can't. And I was nothing without my leadership group and also kind of non-assigned leaders outside that group. I couldn't do everything and I couldn't build a relationship necessarily with every person in that same depth of way. And actually it was about using the strengths of other people around me to say, okay, you've got this best connection, or you can lead on this far better than I. Mm-hmm. Let's do this together, and not feeling that I am weakened or lesser by doing leader, which I think is really common.
It's interesting because you talk there's so many elements that you've just brought up in that response there to what is leadership and what are those traits and things that I suppose we, you know, some things that we'll come on to there, some of the traits of leadership. And of course you then bring that wealth of knowledge and understanding that you gained in the sporting arena, you've now kind of shifted focus somewhat and are now starting to bring those skills and those leadership abilities that you learn as a sports person into other arenas, and particularly in the context that we're talking about and obviously in context of Arch Insurance into the business environment. How transferable are these skills into the business world? And how also have you, I suppose, worked to almost make them, these skills sort of digestible or relevant to that business world?
Yeah, I mean, I think they're as transferable, I suppose, as you want them to be. I mean, for me, they are hugely transferable. I'm biased because ultimately they're about people and team. And whether that's in a sporting environment or if it's in an insurance environment or any kind of business or organisation or corporation, there are people and there are teams within those companies. And it's about how you can get the best out of your people for the service of that team and to enable people and the team to be as successful as they possibly can be. And I think there's lots of elements in there which I think are huge transferable. And it's just, you know, just finding inspiration and curiosity from lots of different sources, and some of it you'll pick up and you'll put down again, and some of it you'll take and you'll absorb and you'll kind of churn it around and you'll make it yours. And I think it's getting it from as many different arenas and I suppose, yeah, different areas and environments as possible. I think that is the best thing that I could suggest. Yeah.
And of course you've now spent sort of, you know, a number of years sort of in this new environment and then speaking to organizations, speaking to companies, speaking to individuals, and of course you're learning about their view of leadership as well. And I'm quite curious actually, because, you know, I just wanted to get, what do you think are some of those areas of leadership that are perhaps overlooked in the corporate world?
I suppose that's perhaps one of the biggest differences, and that's the thing that sticks out for me is that, you know, in our environment, you know, there were either 28 or 31 players, and there were kind of 10 or so management kind of surrounded us. You know, you go into corporation, it's, you know, corporation, and sometimes it's thousands of people.
Of course, yeah.
And, you know, that if you're talking kind of C-suite, if you're an executive, you know, you're leading potentially thousands of people, and it's, you know, can you have that touch point with everybody? No, but okay, how can you follow through, and how can you set the example
on
cultural standards and behaviours, and really follow through on them? Because, you know, the number of times I've heard, you know, I'm open, I'm here to talk, my door's always open, but is it and can people talk to you? How reachable are you? How attainable are you? How do you fully understand and appreciate and have empathy and connection with every level of your business? Because it often in business there's always hierarchy, whether it's natural hierarchy or
very hard to avoid.
Designated hierarchy. But I think it's about cutting through that and really thinking about building things for and with everybody in mind, and that is can be at every point in every day. And I think if leaders are doing that and are constantly bringing people into the table and actively listening to those voices, then I think those are the organizations that are really thriving. People are thriving, they want to stay in the business, they're motivated to do more.
Absolutely,
the best. You know, you're the best salespeople as well, because, you know, they're going out saying, God, this company's brilliant, and I'm going to buy that thing. My friends are, because they...
Your best, I suppose, without wanting to use the phrase marketing tool, but one of your best marketing tools are your people. And if you can encourage them to, through your sort of, you know, involving, engaging leadership, to actually then go out and demonstrate proactively to the rest of the business world that this is an amazing company that's behind me, then, you know, that's a fantastic achievement.
Yeah, care for your people and they'll care for you. I think that still holds very true.
I wanted to, if I can, and just talking on that subject of leadership, and obviously having to, you know, listen to some of the things that you've said about leadership in the past, and one thing that particularly stuck out for me was you talk about how important it is for people to work out who they are as a person first, and this very personal journey that they kind of need to take before they can really sort of, I suppose, start to define themselves as a leader. But that's an incredibly challenging step for a lot of people to take, that sort of inward-looking component of it. And also, I suppose that takes time as well. It takes time, and it takes that sort of, you know, you almost need to go to that safe space that we were talking about earlier, where you can actually sort of really spend that quality time getting to know who you are as a person. Just how challenging is that, particularly in a workplace, in a business environment?
It's incredibly challenging. It is absolutely challenging. But giving yourself that time, it will not only help you as a leader in a business sense, but it will help you outside of your business life. It will help you in your other teams that you are in, whether that's sports teams or a family unit or a friendship group.
Of course, yes.
That kind of level of understanding of, you know, what are my strengths in this environment? What are my super strengths? What am I consistently good at? How can I consistently deliver my A game? What do I need to do mentally, physically, and emotionally to prepare myself every day or before every meeting or before every call to be able to be that person? What am I like on a good day? What am I like on a bad day? What are the triggers that move me from a good day into a bad day? And can I be mindful and conscious enough of those things to kind of halt them in their path? Like, can I actually take control of my mental state? And I think it is incredibly hard, but it's about that giving yourself the opportunity to have that self-reflection.
Yes.
And also have fun with it. I think, you know, have
that's interesting.
Do some fun things with your team. You know, send a piece of paper around the room with your name kind of at the top, and then pass it around, and people write what they think your super strength is and pass it around. Everybody will have a sheet of paper with what everybody in their team thinks about them, what they value in them. That's like gold dust stuff that we never talk about, but can really make a difference to someone's performance and energy and confidence. And, you know, there's loads of little things that you can do like that, I think, to really just have that prompt thought. You know, listening to podcasts like this, for example, is a brilliant way for you to go away and think, I've not thought about that before. You know, what am I like on a good day? What am I like on a bad day? And how does it affect how I perform and how I interact with my team? And maybe I could have a conversation about that over, you know, coffee or lunch with a teammate next time. And I think it's again, just, you know, digesting lots of different stuff, thinking about it, sitting with it, getting curious with it, thinking about it internally, and then share it with the people around you. Because leaders, great, 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 great leaders are never done. It's never done. Then you're never the finished article. And I think, I wish there was this wonderful place that we could all reach, but
leadership nirvana. That
but actually, the joy is in all of that stuff, is in all of that growth, is in the learning from the losses and the wins.
I suppose that's a really important thing to acknowledge as well, that this is a continuous process. So I suppose, actually, can I take you back, because you talk there about sort of that openness there, and that sort of, I suppose with openness as well comes that sense of vulnerability. And I think perhaps in a business world as well, where that idea of showing your vulnerable side, showing almost your personality to a degree, or you, and I mean that in a sort of like, this is who I am as a person. There's probably, I would have thought, a degree of reticence about doing that, a nervousness and not wanting to show your flaws or your vulnerabilities or to be that open, perhaps. How do you overcome that?
Yeah, I've thought about this a lot recently, because I think it is the key to everything. I think there's a thing called the vulnerability loop, that if I'm vulnerable with you, you're more likely to be vulnerable with me and another person, and then it just keeps feeding itself. Mm. And through vulnerability, we can find our whole selves, and we can actually accept all of ourselves, and we have a greater ability to be empathetic and understanding of everybody else around us, and that enable them to thrive and be their best self as well. So vulnerability is really key, but it is really hard. And I've heard it many, many, many times. And I probably thought myself at some point, and I've heard it from my own leaders, that there's a fear that vulnerability will make me appear weak.
Yes.
There's a fear that being vulnerable will be me showing that I'm not strong enough. And that it's a chink in my armor for somebody to attack.
Yeah.
And it is brave, and it is hugely courageous, and it's where the good stuff lives. So, you know, if you want to go to that next level, if you want to embrace that next level of leadership and really develop yourself and the people around you, vulnerability is where it lives. Yeah. And I think somebody that, for me, it sticks out in my mind is Brené Brown, who's a sociologist and a researcher. If you've never heard of her, she has got some exceptional TED Talks. If you like TED Talks, she does podcasts, sure. She's got some books. How she brings vulnerability to life in a real meaningful way through storytelling, I think we'll reach out to a lot of
people. Excellent. That's a great suggestion. And it's interesting as well that some of the words that you've been using in the context of leadership are probably words that in the business arena, they wouldn't associate these character traits or whatever with being a good and effective, a strong leader, whatever that might be. And you talk about kindness, you talk about empathy, you talk about mindfulness. You know, just how integral are these to leadership, and how much does there need to be a sort of a sense of eye opening in the business arena to what it means to be a leader?
I mean, certainly, goodness, when I was growing up and for the longest time, all the leaders that I were led by were very autocratic. I say, you do, it's some one voice from the top, you get on board or you get off. That was what I thought leadership was, which was terrifying to me. And there are times and there will be contexts and there will be environments and there will be decision points where that is exactly what is required.
Yeah.
So it's important here to get the balance. I think it's important to acknowledge that at times it will be this, I am making the decision. It isn't a conversation and this is the reason why. But being clear about where you're sitting on that decision-making process, actually, this is totally your decision. Myself as the leader, I'm empowering you to make a decision.
Yes.
I will go with it. Why? And I think if you take people with them on that journey, they might not always like it, but I think they will at least understand where you're coming from as a leader. And understand that when I say care and being kind, sometimes that requires a really hard, challenging conversation.
Of course.
And care and kindness can be, of course, it can be an arm around the shoulder and, you know, a very kind of what we think about a nurturing in that sense. But it can also be, look, I believe you have got more in you and I want to help you get more out of you. This is, let's work together to try and, you know, what's your perspective? What's your point of view? Let's work together and let's really push.
Yeah.
You know, also, that's also kindness. I'm doing you a disservice if I don't challenge you and get the best out of you as well at the same time. So I think it's just getting that balance.
Yeah, and I suppose making people aware that they have a role to play in this. And interestingly, you talked about sort of, you know, I suppose from some people's perspective, leadership is about power, but in actual fact, as you said, leadership is actually about empowering. It's about sort of spreading that power. It's about giving others power.
Yeah, I think if there's a contextual framework, if there's a knowledge of a total understanding from all parties what the direction of travel is, what the context is, that the capabilities are known and assured, then I think that's a great environment to empower. There will be other contexts and other rights where actually, as I said, it's not the time to empower people. Actually, it's time to just one person to make a decision. And that's also really cool.
Yeah, absolutely. Those situations happen and that is required of the leader.
Yeah.
I wanted to come back, if I can, just to this idea of pursuing better together. You know, today I will learn something about leadership. I have been leading for a period of time, but today I will learn something else. I will learn something new, and it will change the way I approach how I am as a leader and how I look to lead others. How important is that recognition of that aspect of it?
It's massive. Mm. It is huge because it's hard work, and there's going to be a lot of failure, and you're going to feel uncomfortable a lot, and you are gonna have to sit with your feelings and your thoughts and work through them, and that's hard. And you know, lots of us at various times want to avoid any of that, but it's what really separates the excellence from good, you know, from being just okay to being one of the best or the best. And I think it's are you prepared to do that work? Are you prepared to work hard, to really have that sense of responsibility to yourself and to your teammates? Because life's going to throw you curveballs. And as we've seen, you know, there's no perfect example in the last kind of 2 years or so.
And you can see
just, you know, you look at the high street, you look online, you see, you know, who has been agile, who has been able to adapt and make decisions and devolve power and leadership and actually be innovative and creative and think of lots of different ways to win, mm-hmm. given the newest scenario, given the, you know, the newest context. And it's kind of like that Thinking Thursday, you know, this is the scenario, go, you have to go and find a way to win, go. And you know, our coach is a phenomenal coach, and he had lots of answers to all the questions that he was posing, but in the middle of a game in the Olympic finals with 15,000 people screaming, we can't hear him. We have to be able to solve it ourselves in the moment, live. And I think it's giving people that sense of ownership and agility and power to make decisions and be creative without risk.
Of course,
constantly. So that when something happens like the last 2 years, we are able to adapt and shift and find that new way.
I suppose that ability to adapt and shift is because beneath all of that, you've got those foundational principles. You've got those base values that are the foundations that gives you that security, that gives you that platform that you can take risks from, you can push from, you can be responsive from. But fundamentally, you know you're standing on solid ground.
Yes, and that's where all good culture, that's all where all great teams start from, is that sense of, we know this is serving our purpose or our vision or whatever it is you want to call it. Everything is of service to that. And you're constantly, therefore, also a little bit reviewing it, and you're checking and challenging it. You know, does this serve our vision? Or actually, does our purpose serve us anymore? Actually, should we change it? Should we adapt it? And it just gives you that healthy bit of, again, nice friction.
Yes, of course. But I suppose, you know, when you speak to people about the concept of leadership, what are the things that you are hoping that people will take away? And for example, on this podcast today, for those who are listening to the podcast, what are the things that you are hoping they will take away and add to their understanding of leadership?
I think first and foremost, I'd say that you are a leader, whether you want to be or not, whether you are an assigned leader or not, whether it's in your job title or not, you are a leader, because first and foremost, you're leading yourself. And how you behave in a team environment, in your organizational environment, is having an impact on the eventual outcomes and goals and visions and mission statements and purposes, but also on the people around you and how they're able to thrive. Every leader leaves a trace. And I think once you get comfortable with that sense of responsibility that you have, I think then think about, I think it's one of my favorite quotes from John Amici that I've read recently. He talks about culture is defined by the worst behavior tolerated. So think about in your environment, you know, what behaviors as a team are we tolerant of and are we not tolerant of? And let's be challenging ourselves and each other against that regularly. We had in the Leap to London our gold medal standards, and everybody knew in the team they could lead themselves against those behaviours, those behavioural standards. And you could then lead each other against them as well. So, and then the last thing I would say is just go within. Like, what are your strengths as a person, as a character? What are your personality traits? What do people value in you? What life? What causes, you know, set your heart a pace and your eyes, you know, light up. Tap into those things, because they will help find what kind of leader you can be and develop your personal style of leadership.
I have one more question, and it's just coming back to this sort of pursuing better together idea again. And of course that is about this always sort of pushing to achieve more. And for somebody who has achieved so much, I just wonder, you know, what are the sort of the three kind of core lessons that you have learned that have always enabled you to set the bar that little bit higher?
First and foremost, I think the thing that stands out for me is that sense of responsibility. I think we spoke about it right at the start and all the way through. It's that sense of responsibility to yourself and to your teammates and to the people that you're serving. So whether that might be customers or consumers or, you know, for us, it was kind of spectators and supporters. You know, be the best version of yourself for all of those reasons. And that continually will motivate you to be better, because there will always be that sense of wanting to hold, you know, yourself account to yourself, to the people around you and everybody else. So I think that first and foremost. And then I think use failure as a fuel to fire you up. I experienced way more failure in my career than successes. And it would have been really easy to have let those failures just kind of push me down each time. And actually, every time I had that initial period of grief, which is completely valid and natural and normal. And then it was then turning that around to say, okay, where are the learnings? How can we make sure that never happens again? Using it as a springboard to bigger and better things. And after every failure in my career, something amazing has happened.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Kate, it's been an absolute pleasure. I've thoroughly enjoyed our conversation. I think you've given us an absolute wealth of incredible insights from your career and you know, also that idea of what it means to be a leader and that idea that it's very much a personal thing as well, and that you've got to look within before you can sort of step up and step out. All there is, I suppose, left for me to do is to thank you so much on behalf of Arch Insurance for your time today. And it's, as I say, been an absolute pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, and good luck with everything, everybody.